Welcome to the podcast of Greenlight Bookstore. This is the quarantine season. While Greenlight isn't currently hosting in-person gatherings, we're still striving for ways to create connection around books. Thanks to the gracious efforts of authors and interviewers scattered across the country and the world, we've taken our events programming online, hosting live readings, conversations, and audience questions via Zoom. Our podcasts this season are a record of those intimate conversations between thinkers and creators speaking from separate rooms, and a window into the ways that ideas and stories connect us all. Once you've listened to the conversation, you can purchase the books mentioned in this podcast at Greenlight's two bookstore locations in Brooklyn or on our website at greenlightbookstore.com.
Welcome to tonight's live online author event with Greenlight Bookstore. I'm Chelsea from Greenlight, and we're thrilled to host tonight's event with Nadia Owusu, presenting the paperback edition of her book, Aftershocks. She'll be talking with Tope Falerin, so you're in for an excellent time. Before we start, I just want to say a huge thanks to Nadia, Tope, and the team at Simon & Schuster for making this happen, and to all of you for showing up. Though we're not able to host events in our store spaces, our community of authors and readers is still here. We're grateful for your support and for the chance to make this space for conversation and connection. And importantly, tonight's featured book, Aftershocks, is available for sale from Greenlight Bookstore. You can shop in person in our bookstore locations, noon to 7 p.m. every day of the week. And you can purchase Nadia's book and many others on site. Or order online at greenlightbookstore.com for a quick pickup at the store or for shipping anywhere in the U.S. And Nadia stopped by our store to sign copies of the book, so you can get a signed book by request while supplies last. Make sure to indicate your signed copy request in order comments at checkout when ordering online, or look for signed copies when you visit the store. If you care about supporting the careers of authors and the ongoing existence of independent bookstores, buying tonight's featured book is a great way to show your support. Our interviewer tonight is Tope Falerin. He is a Nigerian-American writer based in Washington, D.C. He serves as executive director of the Institute for Policy Studies and the Lannan Visiting Lecturer in Creative Writing at Georgetown University. He has garnered many awards for his writing, including the Kane Prize for African Writing and the Whiting Award for Fiction. He was educated at Morehouse College and the University of Oxford, where he earned two master's degrees as a Rhodes Scholar. His debut novel, A Particular Kind of Black Man, was published by Simon & Schuster. He'll be speaking with our featured author, Nadia Owusu. She is a Brooklyn-based writer and urban planner. She's the recipient of a 2019 Whiting Award. Her lyric essay, So Devilish a Fire, won the Atlas Review Chapbook Contest. Her writing has appeared or is forthcoming in the New York Times, the Washington Post, The Lily, Literary Review, Electric Literature, Epiphany, and Catapult. Her book, Aftershocks, is a deeply felt memoir about the push and pull of belonging, the seismic emotional toll of family secrets, and the heart it takes to pull through. The book has been praised by fellow writers such as Mitchell S. Jackson, Margot Jefferson, Bessie Ipke, and Jessica Andrews, who calls Aftershocks a white-hot interrogation of the stories we carry in our bodies and the power they have to tear us apart. Owusu illuminates the blood and bones wrought by our borders and teaches us the necessity of owning our narratives when personal and collective histories have been shattered by violence. Nadia is going to start us off with a reading from the book, and then she'll be talking with Tope and with all of you. Nadia, please take it away.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Chelsea. Thank you, Greenlight, for having us. I'm just going to read from the beginning of the book, from a chapter called First Earthquake, and I'll just read the first few pages. My mother's hair is long, straight, and black. It blows behind her in the wind. She is walking away again. In the moonlight, she is a phantom ship drifting out on obsidian waters toward the place where the sky and ocean meet, disappearing over the curvature of the earth, and the moment is so evanescent, so intangible, that I am already wondering, a wisp of her still in sight, if she was ever there at all. She does not turn to see me in the doorway. I am 7 years old, bundled up in a pink sweater and down-stuffed coat, my bobbled hat pulled down past my eyebrows. My white socks are dingy and damp from the rain that seeped into the black canvas shoes I insist on wearing, no matter the weather. I want to call out to her, but I'm afraid she will not turn around. Or worse, that she will, but still won't choose me. She gets into the passenger seat of the blue Fiat her husband borrowed from an acquaintance. They are passing through Rome for a day on their way back to Massachusetts. They vacationed in Venice. Earlier, before my mother arrived without sign or signal, I woke up to the sound of rain. It was dark outside, so dark I thought it might still be night until I smelled pancakes. My father makes pancakes on Saturday mornings. As I ate my breakfast, face buried in a shabby copy of Little Women, my father fretted. He tapped his foot, peeped at his watch, pushed his glasses up the bridge of his nose. I wondered what was making him anxious and hoped that whatever it was wouldn't require him to sit at his desk all weekend. He had just returned from a work trip to Dhaka. I wanted him to myself. The radio, always perched on the kitchen counter next to the toaster, its bent antenna somehow finding the BBC World Service, brought news of a catastrophic earthquake in Armenia. Tens of thousands of people were killed. Hundreds of thousands lost their homes and everything in them. A city called Spitak was destroyed. A new city, the woman on the radio said, would have to be built over the ruins. Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev asked the world for help. On my pancake, I spread butter and sprinkled sugar. Does Mama have family in Armenia? My father flinched, then looked at me with wide eyes magnified by Coke bottle glasses. No, he said. Her family are Armenian, but they lived in Turkey. They all live in America now. We usually avoided the topic of my mother, but the BBC said this was an emergency. Rules are suspended in emergencies. I am half Armenian, but was not sure if the earthquake had anything to do with me. My Ghanaian father, stepmother Annabelle, sister Yasmin, and I live in Italy. This was the first I'd heard of the Caucasus Mountains, the fault rupture point that caused the event. I asked my father what an aftershock was. He said they are tremors in the earth that follow an earthquake. They are the earth's delayed reaction to stress. The doorbell rang just as I was about to go upstairs to brush my teeth. Yasmin, who had stumbled into the kitchen rubbing her eyes, jolted awake and scampered after me to see who it was. We hoped our friends from next door had come to play. Our mother was on the front porch with two red balloons and shaking hands. I stared at her. Remembering my voice, I shouted for my father to come. We hadn't seen my mother in 3 years, not since I was four. My father nodded hello and sent Yasmin and me to get dressed. When we came downstairs, my parents were still standing in the hallway. They weren't speaking. My mother's hands were in her pockets. She had let go of the red balloons, and they had floated up to the ceiling. Her head dropped. My father's shoulders were drawn back, his legs spread apart. Your mother is going to take you for a drive. My father opened the closet and pulled out our puffy coats. I could feel him on the other side of the front door when he closed it behind us, as though to say he would be there exactly where we left him when we returned. My mother's husband drove, silent, while my mother chattered. Our half-sisters were dying to see us. She would bring them next time. Venice was a magical place. She could hardly believe it was real. Our grandparents bought us a kite in the shape of a fish. Our father would show us how to fly it in the spring. Despite the drizzle, my mother's husband dropped us off in Piazza Navona. An artist drew a funny sketch of us together with bulbous heads and startled eyes. We ate at a cafe, plates of spaghetti al pomodoro. All of us requested lots of Parmesan cheese. My mother asked about school and said she liked our house, even though, as far as I knew, she had only seen the hallway. I asked her about the earthquake. She hadn't heard the news. Someday we'll all go to Armenia, she said. It sounded like half question, half statement, so I said yes, even though I didn't believe her. As we left the restaurant, a juggler swept over, grinning. His hands seemed to barely move, but his blue, yellow, and red clubs hurtled high above his head. He caught two in one hand and one in the other and bowed deep. My mother clapped. Yasmin and I, always tentative around strangers, considered the cracks in the paving stones. My mother pressed a few gold and silver 1,000 lira coins into the juggler's hand. She also gave one each to Yasmin and me to toss into the Fontana dei Quattro Fiumi. I told my mother what my father told me about the fountain, about how the four figures in it are the gods of four rivers on four continents, the Nile, the Ganges, the Danube, and the Rio de la Plata. Above the gods is an obelisk topped with a dove. The obelisk represents the Catholic Church. The river gods are powerful, but they prostrate themselves before the Vatican. The fountain is a symbol of colonialism, I whispered, echoing my father, who speaks to me like I'm a grown-up. Colonialism, as I understand it, is white people stealing land from black and brown people, white people beating and killing black and brown people, white people forcing black and brown people into slavery and servitude. My father, I know, was born in the last year of colonial rule in what was then the Gold Coast. He says being born as Ghana was being born was the beginning of his good fortune, of our good fortune. I liked that my mother laughed and told me I was smart. When I threw my coin into the water, I closed my eyes tight and listened to my mother's laughter sing with the sound of water. That sound was the wish I dared not shape into words, because words could be misconstrued. Now I watch my mother get into the blue Fiat. Her husband starts the ignition. To see her more clearly, I squint. She rests her head against the window, and I imagine, or perhaps hope, she is crying. The car pulls away, absorbed by the night. I sniff the air for exhaust or perfume, for any remnant of my mother's presence, but I smell only wet limestone and garlic. My stepmother Annabelle is cooking dinner. Piazza Navona seems far away now. We live in Eur, a neighborhood known by an acronym for the Esposizione Universale di Roma, a world's fair that never happened because of the onset of World War II. Eur was built by Mussolini to celebrate 20 years of fascist Italy and to expand the city to the sea. Unlike the rest of Rome, Eur is an orderly place. Its buildings are solid, polished white, and arranged around a grid of right angles. Usually, its predictability makes me feel safe, but now it feels inhospitable, spiritless. Somewhere in the house, my sister shrieks. She does not want to take a bath. Her anger, I know, is about something else entirely. With a last deep breath, I inhale whatever particles of my mother remain and close the door behind me. I'll stop there.
Such a fantastic reading. Thank you so much for that, Nadia. And I have to say, I've been looking forward to this for quite some time. I read this book at the beginning of the year and loved it and have reread passages of it since then. So congratulations to you on this wonderful book and on the paperback coming out. I guess I wanted to start by asking why you wrote this. What motivated your desire to write this book?
Thank you so much for your kind words. I'm such a fan of your work. So I was also very excited to get to be in conversation with you today. Thank you. I started writing this book as a private project. It was a way for me to kind of overcome the aches of isolation and dislocation and disconnection, which I think are all things we're all getting really familiar with right now. Yeah. But I began writing from a place of grief. You know, I lost my father when I was 13. My mother left when I was 2. And because my father worked for the UN, I grew up moving around every couple of years, which was in many ways a wonderful way to grow up. But in other ways, you know, I felt like I was always saying goodbye to a home. There was always a lot of loss, even though we didn't necessarily acknowledge it. But you know, that kind of grief and loss, it stays with you. And I think as I moved into my 20s, I realized that, you know, I was carrying all of this grief and it was becoming really heavy. And so I had this really strong sense that I needed to sort of write into the histories and the cultures of the places that my parents came from, places that I had always been somewhat disconnected from or kind of straddling or, you know, sort of a little bit on the outside of. I'm what people call a third culture kid, which means that I grew up outside of my parents' cultures. And although I was raised by my Ghanaian father, but I, you know, for example, didn't speak his language. And so there were always ways in which I was, you know, really kind of longing to belong even within my own family. And because my mother left when I was 2, my Armenian identity was not something that I understood or really had access to. You know, my father talked to me about my mother's family and culture a little bit, but for the most part, I really didn't feel that strong sense of connection and belonging. And so in my 20s, I just felt this drive to kind of write myself towards deeper understanding of those places, of those cultures, of my family, of the context in which my parents were sort of making decisions, to kind of understand myself better, and also to understand the other places that I had lived where history was often being made all around me.
Sure.
Because I went to international schools, you know, we didn't learn about that history very much. We were learning about sort of the history of Europe, not about the Civil War, for example, that was taking place in Ethiopia where I lived. And so I wanted to honor all of those histories and cultures, and it felt like a really strong impulse and almost obsession. And so I was kind of doing that for myself, kind of both writing, you know, the stories of my own life and then putting them next to these histories and seeing where the threads connected, and going down a lot of rabbit holes of research. But, you know, I did that for quite a long time before I asked myself, okay, is this something that I might make art out of and turn into a story that I would share with others as well?
Wow. So this kind of leads to something I wanted to ask later, but I'll ask it now. And that's about the structure. I suppose it's a nerdy literary question. I can't help myself. You know, I hope everyone doesn't mind. But one of the things I admired most about the book is the structure of it. And the fact that there are these kind of essayistic portions of it, and then it goes back into your stories and stories about your life, stories about the people you care about, and people you don't care about as well. and I couldn't help but think about, like, I thought a little bit about Zinzi Clemens' work, What We Lose. I'm not sure if you've had a chance to read that book, but she does something kind of similar. It's a different book, but if there's anything that connects both texts, it's that. So I was wondering how you happened on that strategy. It sounds like it was trial and error, but is it something that you, did you initially plan to write like a straight memoir and then over time began to incorporate more, you know, I suppose, histories about the place where you lived, or did you always have that strategy in mind?
Yeah, so I think a lot of that happened really organically, because it felt really important to me. Like, I really felt that in order to understand, I've always had the sense that history, we are made up of history, you know, that we carry history within us, and that you know, we are sort of history living and breathing. And I remember vividly my father, for example, telling me about how the trauma of the Armenian genocide was in my family's DNA on my mother's side. And he told me that in answer to, you know, I had asked him why my mother left when I was really young. And he told me that story about the Armenian genocide and said that my mother came from a family that carried a lot of trauma. And I didn't really fully understand that answer at the time or why he was telling me about this history. But I did get a really strong sense, you know, from a very young age, that there are ways in which we carry history, and that idea kind of stuck with me, you know, and this question of how our histories shape us, not just, you know, our experience and choices, but who we are and how we feel in the world and in our bodies. And, you know, I think also because I grew up moving around so much to different countries, and, you know, history was always being made all around me because of my father's job, we were often following disasters. Yeah. And, you know, my father sort of made sure that I understood, because I wasn't learning a lot about what was going on all around me in school, my father kind of made it his job to sort of teach me about those stories. And he was always very much engaged and always telling us about how the conflicts we were living in the midst of were tied to older conflicts, to colonialism and empire, and how violences are connected. And of course, you know, as a child, I was very annoyed that, like, everything became a history lesson. But that sense of history really became sort of grounded in who I am and how I understand the world, which I think is why when I was coming out of this period of depression, my answer to sort of like, how can I process this and how can I better understand my feelings and how I'm carrying them, was to research some of these histories. And so, you know, because I started doing it just for myself, that was a really organic thing at first.
Yeah.
But then when I did go back to some of that raw material that I created for myself, I did start to ask myself sort of like, how do all of these pieces fit together? Because I had sort of collected a lot of really personal stories and then sort of these like files of research that I had accumulated over time. But I did because of that natural impulse, which, you know, as a writer, I think like often following what our impulses are is can lead us to sort of what the story wants to be as opposed to imposing a structure. So because of that, I really had a very strong feeling that I needed this to be a genre fluid book, and that I wanted to move back and forth between sort of between my private griefs and struggles and these larger forces, and that part of the project of the book was to show how history is always present in our lives, whether we notice it or not. And so, so I ended up sort of like going into that material and then sort of finding stories, my personal stories, and connecting them to those histories. And so many of the chapters of the book start with a very vivid memory, such as, you know, the one that I read today, but then they open up into explorations of broader philosophies or histories. You know, for example, you know, going on a trip to Ghana with my father opens up into a sort of meditation on Pan-African philosophy, or that memory of asking my father why my mother left in the book sort of opens up into an exploration of the Armenian genocide and my ancestors' trek through the Syrian desert and becoming American. And so, but I think once you start examining those connections, like so much cracks open. And so I knew that that's really what the book wanted to be, and that there wasn't really, I couldn't imagine a way of writing kind of a linear memoir, connecting all of the different stories and histories and places and languages that are part of who I was and who I am. And because that is who I am, I felt like I needed to sort of honor all of that.
Yeah, I get that completely and understand that impulse. And, you know, it's so interesting. There's so many similarities, you know, I think in our work in a weird way and sort of in our trajectories as well, that it's just interesting to think about it, because you have just said a lot of things that I've kind of contemplated as I was writing my book and as I write now. One thing I noticed when I was writing my book is that I had to kind of change in order to write it. I don't know if that makes sense, but I couldn't be the person I was in order to bring the book into the world the way the book wanted to be. So I was wondering what your book required of you as you were creating it. I guess another way of asking this is, how did you have to change to bring this story to life?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I definitely see so much that connects our work on so many levels, just like on the level of theme, on the sort of grappling with identity, on the questions around mental illness and you know, inheritance and all of those things. There's so many themes that connect our work. I did have this sense that that part of the project of the book was sort of moving into more fully into like new possibilities for who I could be in the world. Yeah. And, you know, I was coming out of a really dark time, and it was almost a question of realizing that, you know, the ways in which I had worked to survive and to build these survival mechanisms were no longer serving me. And they had served me. You know, I think that, it was also important to me to honor the ways in which those things were necessary, those mechanisms were necessary for a long time. But I had to realize that I needed to let them go, and I needed to, as an adult, you know, to sort of grapple with the grief and the trauma of my life, that I couldn't run away from it anymore, that I couldn't sort of power my way through it in the ways that I had through achievement, through, you know, accomplishment, all of those things that I felt would sort of solve the problem of why I was grieving. And so I needed to sort of be more honest about those stories. And that did require me to sort of to become, you know, a different person, because I was always a person who avoided looking directly at my trauma or my grief. And so I really had to become a person who was open to kind of this deep reflection and self-examination. And, you know, as a writer, I think we do write to think through the questions that we're carrying. And, you know, like those questions are often sort of, where do I fit into the histories of my family? Where do I fit into the places that I call home? And I wanted a deeper kind of, sense of connection to those people and places, as I said. But I also, you know, I did start writing from a place of grief and sort of examining that grief, as I said. But I also found that, through the writing, it opened up so much sort of love and compassion in me as well, that because I was hiding from my grief that I didn't have access to, you know, even sort of the loss of my father, which was one of the great tragedies of my life. You know, he was the great hero of my life. He was a single father to me and my sister until he remarried, but was always sort of the guiding force of my world. And so, after I lost him, because when I was 13, because I was so resistant to sort of examining that grief and to feeling it fully, and I felt like I needed to keep moving forward and powering through it, what that meant was that I also lost access to the love and joy that was so much a part of our relationship. And so in part, sort of writing the book as well sort of allowed me to reconnect to that as well.
That's a great response, and I relate to so much of that. And as I think about your book, it seems to me that so much of your book is about the act of like personal storytelling, which is to say the act of creating a narrative about yourself, right? Like, and that's something that I struggled mightily with when I was growing up. I didn't know how the hell to define myself, especially relative to other people in my life who seem to have a very solid sense of self-definition or sense of, you know, sort of their place in the world. And it seems like your book is about how the act of personal storytelling is kind of inextricably linked with sanity, right? Like, it's about creating a coherent narrative of self, which is something that I suppose all human beings require in order to kind of, you know, live and exist and be productive. So do you have a coherent sense of self now after this process? And did writing this book help you achieve that?
Yeah, that's such a great question. You know, I think for me, part of my struggle was sort of the demand that the world has often imposed on me, and like that the world imposes on so many of us, to kind of see our identities as fixed and have the correct answers. You know, I can remember being sort of very young and people asking me where I was from, and, you know, depending on who was asking me and what I thought it was that they were after, I would sort of shift my answer. But I remember feeling a lot of anxiety about that. And, you know, in all sorts of contexts, like I can remember sort of arriving in Ghana with my father and some people at the airport. I had always been taught to say that I was Ghanaian. I do feel very much, you know, connected to my Ghanaian identity because I was raised by that side of my family. But I remember sort of arriving in Ghana and the people who were checking our passports sort of asking where I was from, and I sort of confidently at that age said, you know, I'm Ghanaian, and they just started laughing, and they were questioning, you know, asking me if I spoke Twi and just sort of interrogating me. And I remember getting very flustered about that and beginning to doubt, you know, my sense of who I believed that I was. And then, you know, similarly, in America, you know, that question of where are you from is so loaded in so many ways, in terms of what people are actually getting at, which often what they want to know is sort of your race or your ethnic background. And the truth was that, you know, I am made up of all of these different cultures, and, you know, with the Armenian side of my family, the Ghanaian side of my family, and then growing up in Uganda, I was born in Tanzania, grew up in Uganda, Ethiopia, Italy, and I have connections to all of those places. But often when I sort of spoke about my identity, I felt that people either thought that I was hiding something or not being honest or that I didn't have a coherent narrative and that I couldn't easily answer the question, and that immediately made me suspect to some people.
Yeah.
And I've also had shifting accents, you know, moving around the I had. And so that confuses people sometimes, you know, if I have a slip in accent. I used to have a very British accent. Now I have an American accent, but sometimes it moves back and forth. And so I think for me, like the kind of the feeling that I needed to have a coherent narrative or like a clear answer about, you know, who I was a sense of great anxiety. And I think part of what I discovered through the writing, and yes, I was sort of crafting a story. So I was crafting a narrative, but it was a narrative that felt like it was coming from my real sense of curiosity about who I was, as opposed to this imposed sense or these expectations that were placed on me. And I was able to sort of, to kind of embrace all of the parts of who I am and to define home really expansively. You know, I often thought of myself as someone who didn't have roots or had, you know, kind of a weak connection to my roots. But what I discovered through the writing and part of the story that I claimed for myself was that actually I have very expansive roots, and that all of the places that I had called home were mine in complicated ways, but those complications are actually a huge part of who I am and are not this shameful thing that I should be afraid about, sort of allowing people to know about me.
Yeah, no, I completely get that. So it sounds like you're saying that that you didn't have to kind of arrive at a coherent narrative, that you just, is that right?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, I guess in one way the narrative is that, you know, that, that I'm rejecting the expectation that I should have an easy answer, right? Like that is still a narrative in and of itself. And sort of what I let go of was like that there's a right answer to those questions, or that there's a fixed answer, you know, that I don't have a shifting sense of self. Like I think we all do in many ways, but I think particularly for those of us who grew up straddling worlds, like we've had to kind of become chameleons. And like, I fully understand why that can sometimes be interpreted as sort of, dishonest or confusing, or can, raise questions for people. But at the same time, I guess my coherent narrative was saying that is the story of who I am, that all of these parts are the story of who I am.
Which kind of aligns with the structure you've created for your book as well. I mean, the book is also saying in its own way, like, you know, take me as I am, you know, even if I'm not sort of fixed in one particular way of being in the world. You reference a lot of art in your book. You know, you talk about Toni Morrison and your love of her and a bunch of other sort of fantastic writers, also jazz and Coltrane and those kinds of people. And then, you know, Peter Gunn's Lord, you know, like rappers from your time that you arrived in New York. I was wondering if you could say a bit more about the kind of art you were engaging with as you wrote this and how that art influenced the book.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was reading a lot of kind of stories that were like engaged with searching for roots, and I defined that sort of really broadly. So certainly, you know, Toni Morrison, there's a lot of sort of journeys towards roots in a lot of her novels. I was also reading a lot of memoirs that were sort of grappling with questions of mental illness. And you know, I was reading those narratives because I was searching for wisdom within them. Like I felt like that they would enable me to sort of see this search that I was on as part of kind of a part of the human experience, you know, as opposed to this really lonely thing that I was going through. I also was listening to a lot of music. I was listening, you know, I reconnected to listening to high life music, which was my father's music, Afrobeat. My father was also a big jazz fan, and he used to talk to me a lot about jazz when I was growing up. And I really liked, you know, what I was doing as I was writing in some ways. And I found this really interesting, particularly as I thought about tracing my roots as someone who has, you know, I was coming to this idea of having really expansive roots, was the ways in which all of those forms of music are connected and there are conversations between them, right? So you can hear sort of the Ashanti rhythms. You know, my father is from the Ashanti tribe of Ghana, and you can hear those rhythms, those really ancient rhythms that are still part of everyday life in Ghana. You can hear them in jazz. And then you can hear jazz sort of returned to Africa and sort of informed Afrobeat, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think that conversation across the diaspora was really important to me because it spoke to sort of my experience as a Black woman who is American and African, and you know, those identities can often be seen as being in conflict. You know, the immigrant Black experience and the African American Black experience are complicated, and we have been in relationship, whether that's in terms of the fight for independence in Africa and the connection to the civil rights movement in America, or in the roots of this music and the conversation between this music. But at the same time, the narrative that is often sort of presented is that there's a lot of tension within those relationships. And certainly there is tension, but I think there is also, you know, so much shared history and a shared sense of who we are in the world and a sense of shared fates in so many ways. And so that was sort of what I was connecting to as well, having spent much of my adult life in the United States.
Yeah, no. So one thing I wanted to ask you when I sort of heard that this would be happening is something that I've been grappling with in my own life for some time. And I'm interested to get your take on it. It's about your work life. So in the virtual green room, we talked about where we're working. And I remember reading somewhere that you worked at Living Cities for a bit. And now, according to The Guardian, you're the director of storytelling at Frontline Solutions. That's funny because I was a sort of vice president of storytelling at LISC. And now I have another job. And one thing that a lot of people, so the connections continue. One thing that a lot of people, like people who aren't writers and people who are writers will ask is like, at what point will you kind of like abandon everything else and commit your life entirely to writing? And the response that I always give is that that's not a great ambition of mine. Like I intend to do like to write great books and be fully involved and invested in a kind of artistic life. But I am also like interested in doing other stuff as well. And to the extent that I can, I'm trying to do both. And perhaps it's like insanity, but at this point, it's something I'm committed to. I'm wondering about your kind of relationship to work. Do you envision for yourself a kind of stepping outside of the work space and committing to life, to writing entirely, or if you intend to continue doing both?
Yeah, I mean, I'm like asking myself, like, are we the same person? Like, there's so many commonalities. Yeah, you know, like you, it's not as though I'm working towards quitting my day job, you know, which is often sort of the way the question is asked. I'm very passionate about what I do sort of in the social justice space and the kind of work that I do. And I feel like the questions that I'm asking in that work are really connected to my curiosities as a writer. And so they are, they like speak to each other in really interesting ways. You know, I'm in my work at Living Cities and like and in the stories that I'm sort of mining for my work at Frontline, I'm asking sort of who places serve and why, like how people feel a sense of security and of belonging. And it's really important in sort of the kind of work I do to reckon with and learn from history. You know, there are so many as we've seen so much, I mean, this has always been true, but I think a big part of the conversation of last summer was this question of what ideologies and philosophies are baked into the systems that exist now and how do we undo them? And like part of my work as a writer is thinking about how do I undo those philosophies that are baked into who I am as a person, you know? And so I think those things are so connected and I feel like my artist life benefits from the work that I'm doing out in the world. And I'm able to then bring the creativity of my artist life into that world. And so, I don't know. I mean, I think it's possible that sort of my relationship to that work might shift and I might do different kinds of work, over time, but yeah, I'm not sort of like the way that I see my trajectory isn't like in a rush towards like quitting my day job per se. I mean, it's always a balancing act though, you know, yeah. We were sort of talking about that before. Like I think as writers, we need a lot of time. And so it's difficult to sort of balance all of the things, but yeah, I'm passionate about both.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're fortunate to live in this like incredible time where there are all kinds of really wonderful narratives that are emerging about people, you know, like us who have grappled with identity, who have grappled with the kind of mental instability that accompanies like traveling from a place that you know and love to a place that perhaps doesn't love you. And the thing that I'm most excited about as a writer is the fact that, you know, I remember vividly, for example, I was a senior, I think I was a senior in college when Purple Hibiscus dropped by Chimamanda. And I was just sort of besotted with that book. And I have other opinions about her that we don't have to discuss, but I was like, this is incredible that somebody's written this book, because the last book I'd read was Nervous Conditions, like a couple years before that. And so it seemed like once every 5 years, it was a book that, you know, kind of talked about my parents' life in some way, or the kind of life that I was, that talked about Pepe Soup. I saw that in your book. I was elated to see that. I love Pepe Soup. So I'm wondering how you feel about like writing at this moment, because you know, I'll say the controversial thing. I think that publishing is still like falling on its face with respect to people like us and not doing as good a job as it could do. Even though, you know, you've had great success that is warranted with your book, and I've been fortunate in certain ways as well. I'm wondering how you feel about writing at this moment.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a great question and one that I've, you know, been thinking about so much. And one of the joys of the past year, you know, it has been, of course, I didn't plan to publish a book in the middle of a pandemic. But one of the joys of this past year is that despite sort of the ways in which we've all kind of been in our homes and unable to travel and to meet people in person, at the same time, I have felt this really strong sense of camaraderie with other Black writers, writers of color, writers from the African diaspora, and have been able to sort of like begin to have these sorts of conversations about sort of what it means to be writing in this moment and sort of the challenges of sort of meeting the expectations of what is still a very white publishing world, you know, and at the same time, like rejecting those expectations and sort of writing the more nuanced, you know, I was having a conversation today with another African writer and we were talking about, you know, both of us sort of engage a lot with African history in our books and somebody was asking us sort of why that was so important. And, you know, that the kind of work that we were writing is sort of non-traditional in the Western sense in that it's not sort of linear. It doesn't, you know, move in one direction. And, you know, my sort of, my sense of that was that like, well, we're African, like we don't see time that way. And so like
we don't.
The presumption in that question is sort of like presumes like the centrality of the white Western experience of the world. You know, for us, like we've always, our ancestors are present where past, future and history coexist. They're circles within circles and we're always moving between them. And so that sense of history, I think for a lot of us is so important. And then also we were talking about sort of the importance of writing. You know, I write about this in my book, but the fact that African history was so left out of my education, like I rarely learned anything about African history. And when I did, it was typically focused on colonialism and the colonial experience, maybe a little bit about the independence movements in college. But a lot of that sort of history, even that history that I got that was about the independence movements, a lot of it was written by white people, right? And it leaves out a lot of the nuance around what existed in pre-colonial Africa. And, you know, and so for that, like, I think for me, sort of turning to my elders and, you know, asking for their stories and histories, which were often sort of much more nuanced and complex than the stories about Africa that were given. And so the importance of sort of telling those stories from our own perspective. And, you know, that's part of the conversation that I think the publishing world is having now about own voices and authenticity. And I think that those are really important conversations. And at the same time, there's still, I think, so much work to do because the expectation is still that that the sort of central position is sort of the white experience.
Yes, amen. I see a couple questions in the chat, so I'll ask one question before going there. And it's about, I think you write really honestly and searingly about privilege and your relationship with privilege in a way that I was surprised by and pleased with as somebody who's also grappled with all kinds of privilege. And the thing that you're honest about in the book is that at certain points in your life, you've had privilege relative to those around you, especially at those moments when you were part of like international communities in places like Uganda and perhaps even Ethiopia, that you had privilege relative to some of the folks there. And other times in your life, obviously, when you didn't have that privilege, you know, when you moved to America and you're kind of figuring stuff out. I'm wondering what your relationship with privilege is now, if that's something you think about and how you conceptualize that.
Yeah, I mean, I think moving to America was really interesting to me in terms of the resistance that people have, and, you know, I would say largely white people have about acknowledging privilege, because I think that there is this really central narrative, which is not an African narrative, that was not very common in my upbringing, about individualism and like individual achievement. And, you know, of course, like there's the stereotype of the African immigrant parents, that achievement is definitely part of our narrative, but it's about achieving for the collective. It's not about sort of like this individualistic view of the world. And so when I arrived here and found, you know, I had always, but my father, it was always a part of the story that my father told me about who I was always that, you know, it was only for, you know, because of circumstance, luck, hard work, all of those things that sort of made my life the way that it was. And that there was very little actually that separated me from, for example, the people in the refugee camps who he was, you know, delivering food aid to. And that was always a story that I grew up with and was aware of, you know, like, I don't think he called it privilege, but that was definitely a conversation and an awareness that I grew up having. And so when I came here and was confronted by this sort of resistance to sort of examining the ways in which we have advantage and the ways in which it is possible to both have advantage and also experience oppression and have disadvantage in certain circumstances was very confusing to me at first.
Yeah.
Because I didn't understand sort of the ethos to which it was connected. And now, of course, I have a much clearer sense of that ethos, like the ethos around the American dream. And, you know, if you work hard, you will succeed. And like, you know, even the conversation that we're having now about sort of freedoms and the freedoms to not wear a mask, for example, you know, which is like something that, you know, in places that are sort of more focused on sort of a collective way of living is something that would be, you know, very foreign in a lot of ways. But, you know, that was always, I felt like it was really important for me to be really honest and reckon with those things, because I think it adds to like the need to have more complex conversations about privilege, about advantage, about oppression, about colorism, about racism, like all of the, we experience all of those things in different ways, depending on sort of our, where we are at the time, our positionality, our relationship to the places and the people that we live among. And so it was really important to me to sort of make, to tell the truth about how complex all of those things have been in my life.
Yeah, no, it's a great, great answer. Looking at the chat now, let's see, Christine Brown says, I am a Black woman adopted and raised by a white family who was very racist. It took me years to reconcile my Black identity without the lens of white supremacy. How did you heal these racial aftershocks?
That's a great question. I mean, I think healing is a process, right? I think it's an ongoing process. I think in terms of the white side of my family, I wouldn't say that I experienced a lot of outright racism from the white side of my family. I was raised by the Black side of my family. So, you know, like that experience was different for me. I think that it was really important to me, however, to sort of reckon with whiteness and my relationship to whiteness. And, you know, and particularly in terms of the Armenian side of my family, I thought that it was a really, you know, as I was doing the research and I discovered that actually Armenians, when they arrived in America, petitioned a court to be considered white. And so that, you know, I was not aware of that history, and that previously they had been racially classified as Asian or Asiatic Turks. And so that, when I learned that, I was like, oh, like this is yet another example of, you know, the ways in which race is truly a social construct, and that that whiteness is a specious thing. And so that sort of like opened up like my ability to have this kind of meditation on race, meditation on colorism. And like, those are questions, you know, I guess to kind of come back to the question about how you heal them. I think like being really honest about those things with ourselves, if we're not able to have to be honest with our families for whatever reasons, is really important. You know, I did have a lot of those conversations with the Armenian side of my family as I became sort of closer to them and was in relationship with them, and so we were able to have conversations about race, and I think that dialogue did help me to sort of move through some of the questions that I was carrying about sort of how race factored into my experience of the world.
Yeah. Let's see. Christine Brown would also like to know what books both Nadia and Sope are currently reading and what authors inspire each of them. I'll let you answer first because I got to collect. Come up with something to say.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I talk a lot about some of the writers that I really admire in my book, and I think at some point in the book I write about sort of having this council of mothers that included Toni Morrison, Audre Lorde. You talked about Tsitsi Dangaremba, definitely her, Zora Neale Hurston, June Jordan, as sort of an urbanist and a writer, has been a big influence on me. Yeah. And then also, you know, as I was writing, as I said, I was also reading a lot of stories about that were engaged in sort of reckoning with writers who were sort of engaged with reckoning with the stories of their lives and struggles and big global challenges on the page. So, you know, Jessamyn Ward's memoir, Men We Reaped, was important to me. Zadie Smith's essays, Negroland by Margot Jefferson. So many stories. Bassi Iqbi's I'm Telling the Truth But I'm Lying, which came out sort of after I had largely written the book, but then when I read it, there was so much recognition in her work, and Kiese Layman's Heavy. Yeah, so many.
Yeah, same lineup of writers for me in many ways. And of course, the ubiquitous, and, you know, Baldwin is somebody who has definitely had an impact. And, you know, a friend of mine gave me this book a couple of days ago. I don't know if you can see it. It's called The Flagellants. It's by Carlene Hatcher Polite, apparently a cousin or somehow related to Toni Morrison. It's a book by a Black woman that came out in the 60s, published in France first and then by FSG in the States. It's about, a couple that is kind of breaking up, a Black couple that's breaking up in France. It's a really interesting book. And not one that I encountered before. And to me, it's been incredible to engage with this book because she's grappling with some of the same concerns that I'm grappling with now. And whenever, you know, folks, let me be more specific. A lot of times when critics in particular talk about work by writers of color, they kind of collapse everything. Mm-hmm. You know, I think they're fond of referencing like one writer. And the other thing that bothers me too is that there's not a lot of conversation about craft when critics talk about Black writers. They talk about the story more than they talk about the craft, which is, I think, highly unfortunate. And I've opined on this in other places. But it's really great to kind of see somebody who is grappling with craft in all kinds of interesting ways. So I've been reading and enjoying that book of late. Let's see, one more question in the chat. Were you able to connect with any Armenian writers? Any thoughts on the philosophical challenges, oppression, being victims of layers of supremacist systems facing Armenians still living on their indigenous lands and Armenians in the diaspora? That's a big question.
That's a very big question. But I think so. The answer, yes, I have been able to. One of the other gifts of this process is that sort of through the writing of the book, I was in some ways I was sort of writing myself toward reconciliation with my mother, which then opened up the whole Armenian side of my family, and it has been really beautiful to be in relationship with them, to learn more about the Armenian culture and sort of the stories that I didn't really have access to when I was growing up, and doing that research for myself also sort of really allowed me to feel more connected to that side of my heritage as well. And then also with the book coming out, I've been sort of really overwhelmed by how, you know, so many Armenian writers and Armenian readers have reached out to me in such lovely ways and offered their, you know, I'm still very much a learner about the Armenian side of my family. And so it's been really wonderful to be in conversation with folks. And I think one of the things that I recognized through those conversations and also through the research that I was doing was, you know, the way, you know, I was talking about sort of the Armenian experience in America, but also, you know, I have been sort of learning more because that's sort of my family's experience of coming over, escaping genocide, and they settled in the United States. But I have also been sort of connecting with Armenians across the diaspora, which has been really interesting to sort of learn about that rich history and also the unique sort of experiences of oppression and of sort of the ways in which Armenians similarly have sort of grappled with some of the same challenges that I have been writing about from the Black experience as well. And so seeing the connection between those two sides of my heritage has been really important and is an ongoing sort of point of curiosity and exploration for me as I continue to learn and move through the world.
Cool. We're bumping up at 8:30, so I think we have an hour, if I'm not mistaken, right? So I'll ask one final question, one that is taken from a quote in your book. So I'll read it now. It says, "The idea of roots setting a person free is counterintuitive, but deracination from the past, from land, from family, from mothers, makes for an unstable present. We must have, or we will always search for, a place to bury our bones." So my final question to you is, do you have a place to bury your bones?
I think, you know, I do, you know, I think that I actually have a few places to bury my bones now. And I think, you know, through these efforts to sort of come to a deeper sense of knowledge and understanding of those places, that I do feel such a, still a complicated connection, but such a strong sense of connection that I now claim those heritages. Like now I feel much more confident if somebody asks me sort of where I'm from or about my background, saying both that I'm Ghanaian and Armenian. You know, like I feel like for much of my life, that was a question that I sort of felt very nervous about. And so I think this sense of sort of connection to those histories has allowed me to see, and those are diasporic communities, by the way. So I think like it's not necessarily the land itself, but it's more this sense of community that I have claimed in really important ways.
Wonderful. So I think we're at the end. I've really enjoyed speaking with you, Nadia. Congratulations again on your tremendous book.
Thank you so much. This is so lovely. Thanks for all your great questions.
Yeah, thank you, Nadia and Tope, for such a wonderful conversation. And thank all of you for coming here virtually tonight and sharing the space for connection with us. A reminder to everyone that you can buy Nadia's memoir, Aftershocks, from Greenlight, either in store at our either of our Brooklyn locations. We're open noon to 7 daily, or online at greenlightbookstore.com. You can find that buy link in the chat, and you can also get a signed copy of Aftershocks through Greenlight right now. Just make sure if you're ordering online to request a signed copy in the order comments at checkout. And you can also buy Tope's very excellent novel, A Particular Kind of Black Man, through Greenlight in store or on our website. Thank you all so much again for an excellent evening, and have a wonderful rest of your night.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Greenlight Bookstore podcast. We're grateful to our production partners at Libro FM for working with us to produce the quarantine season. Libro FM provides access to thousands of digital audiobooks through partnerships with independent bookstores nationwide. You can purchase Libro FM audiobooks at greenlightbookstore.com. You can subscribe to the Greenlight Bookstore podcast on iTunes, download it as a free audiobook from Libro FM, or stream it on greenlightbookstore.com/podcast. On the Greenlight website, you can also find links to purchase the books discussed in this episode and many more, as well as information about Greenlight's store locations and shopping hours. The best way to support your local independent bookstore and the literary communities we serve is as simple as buying a book.